Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, Episode 18, Hardcore Calibration. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheaterMag.com. My guest geek of the week is Joel Silver, founder and president of the Imaging Science Foundation. Hey, Joel, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott, and thanks for a promotion to Geek of the Week. I've been in that.
Man, you are one of the geekiest geeks I know, so I'm really happy to have you on the show.
Well, we've been having a good time dabbling with video, and these are just golden days for us right now.
Yep, so it is. So it is. Well, listen, I wanted to start right off with the importance of calibrating your TV. Now, Imaging Science Foundation is based on the importance of calibrating your TV, and I know you've got a lot of interesting things to say about it, which we'll get into in the next hour or so. But why don't you start us off with just your basic overall hit of why TV calibration is so important.
Well, I started in this business, like many of my clients, as a hobbyist. Spent probably a little bit too much on a video system and got way too little in return. Similar to what I found in audio, that setup became as important as the components themselves. So one of the things we had to figure out in the early days is just how pictures got to look so bad, considering the amount of engineering that went into television sets. And we had met a number of the engineers when I was with the magazines, and the rock-solid engineering staff was producing some not-so-solid images. So some detective work got us to understand the plight that every manufacturer to this day is still under, that the retail showroom floors and the environments and the lighting where they sell TVs is going to be how we calibrate TVs too. So it's not that TVs don't come calibrated. They do come calibrated. They come calibrated to look best in the environments where they must be sold, the retail showroom floors, with hostile, harsh lighting, a lineup of TV sets, one next to another, where people are just trying to get your attention by having the brightest, sharpest-looking possible monitor, which doesn't translate very well into our typical homeowner, where we've got incandescent or subdued halogen lighting and the windows closed, and the majority of our viewers working in the daytime and watching TV at night. So the critical thing for users to understand is, just like in audio, the room is a component, and the room determines how you're going to be able to calibrate your system's audio and video to optimize the performance for the end users. So one of the nice things that's happened over the past 4 to 5 years, the amount of TVs now that have calibration controls that are well-designed has exploded exponentially. So the need for calibration is, you know, made necessary by the retail environment that manufacturers have to calibrate to survive. The reality is now, thankfully, we have a lot of friends helping us by performing tons of calibrations.
Now, of course, only a very small fraction of TVs are shown on the showroom floor, but I guess they have to calibrate all of them, all the TVs leaving the factory, because they have no idea which one is going to end up being taken out of the box and put on the showroom floor.
They're precisely right. They're going to the lowest common denominator, as they must do to survive. And there are a number of things they do. One of the more distressing things they're forced to do is to add a little bit of overscan, make the picture a little bigger to hide the corners, which we've been forced to do since content often has aberrations either on the top of the picture or on the sides of the picture. We've got some unnecessary and unfortunate data being added to the live video fields. And if you don't overscan the picture, that intrudes upon people's TVs and they return them instantly. Now, what sounds like an innocent little problem where you make the picture just a little bit bigger is destroying the bit mapping of 1080p. So one of our canned inside jokes is a kind of Shakespearean drama. It goes along the lines of 1080p to be or 1080p not to be. And that was quite original here, but we did hear it before. But the nice part is with click of a couple of buttons, you can get some TVs into the right aspect ratio or the right setting, and at least your 1080p content matches the screen and the resolution is not destroyed. But I don't know of a manufacturer on the planet that can ship a set with the right bitmapping option set and live with the amount of content out there that will cause aberrations in the sides of the corners. So
now let's just make sure everybody understands. If you're looking at your high def TV, and in particular, if you're watching a standard def channel and you have overscan turned off, and we're going to explain a little bit more about that in a second, you'll often see what I call digital hash at the top of the screen, little tiny black and white squares that flash on and off in various patterns. And this is actually data being sent along with the video image, right?
And it's improperly being sent along. You're actually looking at data that's intruding on the area that we call the active picture area. That's supposed to be saved for the pictures elements that are supposed to be coming to you. And the history of television has shown that 5 to 6% overscan in the CRT was normal. People are used to using 2 to 3% of the picture for data. And when you see that, you can't look around it. So every manufacturer is faced with the same problems. But
now, overscan was more important with CRTs, right?
Well, it was necessary with CRTs. You couldn't function without, because the edges of the picture in NTSC were far from neat. And on our projection NTSC TV sets, the geometry controls were so crude and poorly set. If you didn't overscan significantly, the pictures were terrible in the corners. So it was a necessary evil in the old days. With flat panels, it's not necessary because of the technology of the panel. It's now necessary because of the limitations of the feeds. It's a tougher item. That's a much tougher item because we don't have to do this in manufacturing because of the televisions. We have to do it in manufacturing because of the content.
Because of the content.
And here's the other catch-22. It never happens in Blu-ray. But how's a manufacturer supposed to know, given four HDMI inputs, which one the Blu-ray is going to be attached to and which one the cable or the satellite might be attached to with the problem? So we have to basically overscan every one of them.
And again, this term overscan is really a leftover from the CRT days when CRTs produced their picture by actually scanning lines up from the top to the bottom. And so overscanning actually caused that process to occur outside of the boundaries of the visible TV screen. Thus the word overscan.
Right. But now it just may be a different aspect ratio.
Exactly. These days it's often called aspect ratio or screen size or screen shape or something like that.
Or something's even worse. I'll give you a scenario. We were just in Hong Kong working with a lovely company there doing a really good job of calibrating mainstream TVs. And we had two brands. I won't mention the brands because both nomenclature menus are difficult. But both TVs from two different brands had two options for aspect ratios. One of the options said 16 by 9, and I expect a number of viewers to really understand that. The second one said just scan. And both TVs had both those options. One brand set at 16 by 9 destroyed 1080p. The other brand set at just scan destroyed 1080p. So the same name meant different things in different
two
brands.
Two different things, which is another problem in our industry, not only with video, although it's certainly here, you know, that there's no standardization of terminology, which bugs the heck out of me.
No, standardization of chaos. We anticipate chaos, and we expect it. But, you know, humans have been accused for years of being tool-deploying creatures, so we use test patterns to see which is correct. An end user can just take a guess and see which picture is smaller. And the smaller one invariably is the right one for 1080p. But if our viewers are seeing a smaller picture, but they see digital noise top or sides, that's not an option for that channel in that input.
That's true. But, and the problem, of course, is that in the CRT days, overscanning did not affect the, well, it did affect the resolution to a certain degree, but it didn't hurt sharpness of what you could see, whereas in flat panel TVs, overscanning does, in fact, affect the sharpness, the detail, the crispness, the clarity of the picture that you're seeing. It actually lowers the resolution that you're seeing by a process called scaling, which is how overscanning is done in fixed pixel displays.
You're much too kind and politically correct. It doesn't. It destroys the resolution. Let's see if we can cover this complex term with some advice from a very good movie we saw.
Okay.
Happy Gilmore. You may remember that movie.
Actually, I'm not an Adam Sandler fan, so I didn't see it.
But let's talk about the movie, and let's talk about 1080p, and let's define 1080p, because 1080p refers to two things.
Yes.
It could be the signal, or it could be the actual TV itself, the display.
Yep.
So if we're fortunate, and we happen to have either 1080i or 1080p, they both can be looked at as a bitmap. You've got 1920 pixels counting left to right, and you've got 1080 counting top to bottom.
Right.
Now, whether it's I or P, the bitmap's going to be the same.
Correct.
Here's why life gets good and why the modern era is wonderful. If the bitmap of the signal coincides with the bitmap of your TV, every pixel finds a home.
Yes.
The reason we go to Happy Gilmore, this was a golf movie, and there was a very specific technical instruction given to the ball. When Happy is sitting on the green, he's about to putt the ball, he tells the ball to go to your home. So, simple instruction, but if we can look at 1080p and we multiply the vertical count by the horizontal count, you end up with approximately 2 million pixels.
Right.
So let's think of 2 million pixels each looking for a home.
Mm.
If the overscan or bitmapping or aspect ratio is in the right position, every single pixel has a home.
Yes.
If you increase that size by 1%, none of the pixels can find their home.
Well, they find some home, but
they can't find
not necessarily the one that they should be at.
Well, they've got to be scaled.
Yes.
You've got to do some scaling. So every pixel has to be digitally massaged by a built-in processor inside the TV set that's turned on. So instead of having a nice, neat bitmap where all the pixels fall into place, you've got chaos.
Yes. Yes, and absolutely.
By the way, there is no great scaling. There is scaling that's less bad.
Yes, exactly. Ideally, we do not want to scale the image if we want the best possible image.
And if we have the fortunate situation where the bitmap of the content matches the bitmap of the TV, we're free from scaling for the first time in a generation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Unless the button is pressed for overscan, which it is in 99% of the homes. So
nothing
comes out of a conversation. If we can make this more public, that there is an aspect ratio or an option that makes 1080p work. And if you paid for 1080p content and you paid for a 1080p display, figure out a way to make them work.
That's right. And the way to do that is to find your aspect ratio control or your screen size control, or in some cases, there's even an overscan control.
Exactly. Nomenclature is all over the map on this.
Yes, yes. If you have an overscan control, you want to set it to 0% or 0% or off or no.
Geeky terms in your menu that I really like dot for dot.
Yes, yes. Pioneer has a setting called dot by dot, and that's fairly clear cut as to what that means. Just scan.
But it's a scary name because you have to find it. But what about Panasonic with their professional sets, 1-to-1 pixel?
Wouldn't that be wonderful if everybody used that name? My God.
But unfortunately, the vast majority of viewers are happy if they get a picture and they never touch the menu.
So, well, yes, and this is really why I wanted to have you on the show, because I want to make sure everybody understands the importance of going into the menu system to improve things, and also to hopefully allay some fear about going into the menu system. Because a lot of people, I think, don't go in there because they think, oh my God, I'm going to mess up the picture. It's going to be horrible. I don't know what I'm doing. It's really not that difficult, nor that scary.
Well, it's even better. When I was a kid, my dad talked me into taking everything apart that was broken. His comment was, it's broken anyway. Take it apart.
So you can't hurt it anymore.
Assuming that 99% of the pictures don't have 1080p, open up the menu. Explore. Again, we promise you it won't catch on fire if you press the wrong button.
That's
not a CRT. You don't have to worry about doing dangerous things. These are fairly indestructible flat panels.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I gave the same instruction to my mom when she first got into computers. She was so afraid to do anything, and I said, you really can't hurt anything. Just press some buttons, and if the worst that happens, we have to reboot the computer, no big deal.
And TVs, thankfully, have a reset button. But you do need some guidance in this from time to time. And that's where your magazines and your online columns are priceless. If people can just pick up a little information from one of your stories about the basic settings. And you and I have had good conversations, and you've had wonderful results about what advice you can give people that's definitive on a TV set, and what advice is in a per TV, per room, per source basis, which is what calibration ends up being. It's not just calibrating a TV itself. It's calibrating a TV to the room and calibrating a TV to the individual sources. That's why most modern TVs, in fact, all of the better brands, have individual memories per input. So you can calibrate a Blu-ray player to look different than satellite, to look different than Wii. And, you know, I'm not a video game person.
Not only to look different, but to look its best.
You can make them all look correct. I'm a little frustrated. I love the Wii Sports and everything else. I've been sitting here innocently waiting for the HD version of it, and I think I'll be waiting for a long time. It's pretty popular, even without taking care of geeks like me who want a high-def one. So that's probably the only standard def feed I find in high demographic homes now, and I find it all over the place.
I don't have Wii. I don't know Wii, so why don't you explain a little bit about that?
Louis, a nice little gaming system that has some of the best sports out there, but it's not HD.
There's no Wii content that's HD?
There's no Wii players that are HD. They don't need to be HD. They're just engaging. But I find so many homes now with a Wii, a PlayStation, and an Xbox. And, of course, the typical satellite and cable, and the usage is across the board. So it's great. And, of course, the Catch-22 he found, if you have young kids and you give them a very big screen TV, a couple of subwoofers, a wireless joystick, and a gaming system, you're hard-pressed to put food in those kids. They just dock with the screen and have a good time.
And yet when you take that standard definition, I didn't know this, that Wii was not high definition. Xbox and PlayStation certainly are. But when you take the Wii standard definition signal and blow it up on a giant high-def screen, that's going to look a little funky.
It's pretty weak, and what's remarkable is the games are well-designed. I walk into homes and say, can I try the Xbox in high-def? They go, in 10 minutes, we're just finishing the game. So, which goes to show an old sage advice that content is king. Even
true
if
enough.
Not HD, the success of that is all based upon the content designs, which has been wonderful.
Yeah.
I'll wait for the high def. In the meantime, it's doing okay without my sale.
Right. Okay. All right.
Well, that covers That covers overscan and aspect ratio. I wanted to start with that because it's such a simple topic, but it's so difficult to get right, and it's so critical to get right because so much time and effort is put into production nowadays of Blu-ray and satellite programming and cable programming to get us good pictures, and one button press basically destroys all the efforts to get the bitmap from the source, maybe 44,000 miles into your home. So if we accomplish a little bit here and get some of the viewers interested in finding the right aspect ratio, we've done a good job. So
yes,
thanks
indeed.
For your time on that.
You bet. In fact, I will point out that many remote controls for TVs that I've reviewed certainly have a button labeled typically size. That's most commonly what it's labeled, or P size for picture size. And you can get directly to that parameter, that one parameter that we're talking about, picture size or pixel mapping or overscan. Just press that one button and your choices of what you can choose to set that to appear on the screen. And you just pick dot by dot or in some cases, just scan. In other cases, 16 by 9. You're going to have to experiment a little bit.
But again, the smallest one is generally the right one, except for the old 4x3, which is very small, but it's not going to fill your screen.
And that's another question about, that's another issue I wanted to raise about aspect ratios, which is that so many people, when they're watching standard def or 4x3 images, they will stretch them to fill the screen because they think, oh, well, I paid for this nice widescreen TV. I want to see the picture cover the entire screen. But that's not the right thing to do either, in my opinion, certainly.
No, the content was designed to be 4x3. There are some very good demos on some movies that are all about preserving 4x3, and we can't knock 4x3. I mean, Casablanca was filmed in it. King Kong was filmed in it. If 4x3 was the original aspect ratio, it's a beautiful aspect ratio. You can compose wonderful movies there, and we did for decades. But you shouldn't be playing it with a oversized, overstretched, very horizontally distorted King Kong.
He's big enough as it is.
And Bogey did not have a weight problem. He was fine.
So, that's right. Well, you brought up calibration, and thankfully, thank you very much for mentioning the work that I do on trying to promote that and get people to do that. And in fact, my last personal blog on ultimateavmag.com does exactly that. It describes the procedure for setting the basic user controls. And that leads me to the topic of calibration and how there really are two levels of calibration. The first level is the basic level that people can do at home by themselves with a setup disc, such as the one you authored and the one that I, in fact, recommend, called HDTV Calibration Wizard. I think that's the official name of it.
Actually, content we rendered for Microsoft. It was in 111 million media center computers, but no one knew it was there. It's now in Windows 7. If you go to the control panel and go into display, you'll see it listed under Calibrate Color. So we're trying our best to get the computer to be part of the home theater business and to get that content on the big screen. But it was designed to be the simplest, easiest, least technical way of doing calibration, and it does not deploy any test patterns.
Which I'm sure people will be happy about that.
We did a little research here based on our own childhood, and we can ask you a question. When you were growing up, do you remember at the end of the night, if your mommy let you stay up late enough, there were these bars of color at the end of the day?
You bet.
An annoying phone. Well, you did see that, and you're a pretty geeky guy.
I'm a geeky guy, and when my parents let me stay up late enough, I did, in fact, see that, yeah.
Did you ever feel geeky enough to call up the station and say, hey, those bars, every night, they're in my face. What's that for? Or did you, like the rest of us, just say, that's for smart people and technical and change your channel, look for content, and then read a book because it was too late to watch any more TV.
Too late to watch TV, right. Nowadays, of course, no channel signs off. I mean, there's no such thing as sign off, but in those days there was. I also remember the Indian head resolution pattern was another one.
You're probably old enough to remember radio. Come on now.
Yeah, I'm afraid. Well, I'm not quite that old. My earliest memories are, in fact, of TV. But anyway, yes, those color bars turn out to be important.
We showed that to hundreds of millions of people, and the engineers were trying to help us, and that's one of the problems we have. We've got two distinct species that work the Earth. They both look the same. They don't sound the same, but they look alike. And the two species, we work with both of them. One species is called humans. The other are engineers. And the engineers really can't talk to the humans. So one of the things we put forth as a rule of thumb at the Media Center edition of Microsoft was that we will not put test patterns in front of humans. We will give them something useful. So we put that out on disk, and since I'm a geeky guy, I'm good at pressing buttons, but I'm not very good at selling things. We went to Noel Lee at Monster Cable, who turns out is very good at selling things, and he likes high-quality things. He's done a very good job of distribution. But let me expand upon your two-pronged approach to calibration by saying we really think there's three prongs. There are three ways to get a better picture. One, and I'll include you in a compliment here. Do your due diligence, read reviews on anything you buy in electronics.
Yes.
Get advice from the pros who have all the tools. So that's
One of the reasons to do that is that as we were talking about earlier, you can't really go into a showroom and adequately evaluate the performance of a TV because it's so misadjusted.
And the lighting's not your home, and
you're
blinded by all the other TVs.
Yes.
So level one, read a review. Get free information. And, you know, you're not going to get all the information you need, but it's a good head start. Level two, spend $30 on a disc. But if you want everything done right, like in all fields, hire a pro.
Now, and that's step three.
I will tell you, as a Microsoft technology partner, I've learned to do something that some people might find impressive. I've got a new computer I'm working with right here. And this one's a rather brilliant machine. It's got a screen designed by DreamWorks working in conjunction with Hewlett-Packard. This is actually the first application for my new PC. But I'm going to be able to take all the data from my old laptop, migrate it to the new laptop in under 7 minutes with no bugs and I'll have perfect utilization. Mm. 7 minutes sound like an accomplishment.
Yeah, I should say.
Do you want to know the secret?
Please.
After 15 years working in a digital domain, I'll share the secret.
Okay.
Tomorrow, I'm going to call my consultant. It will take me 7 minutes to get him on the phone, give him a purchase order, and make an appointment. I will go out and work with dealers on calibrating TVs. He will come over. All the data will be migrated in. It will be done perfectly. I will hire a professional to do it right because it's less expensive than me giving up a whole day, getting frustrated, moving programs that may not work well in a new environment on a 64-bit machine versus a 32. So I'll hire a pro for what I'm not good at.
It's only going to take you 7 minutes, but it's going to take him a lot longer. But you don't care because you're going to be going out and doing stuff that you know how to do.
Well, I know two things. I'm either going to make more money doing what I do than he's going to charge me,
right,
or I'm going to be having more fun doing something that I enjoy, like riding my bike or playing tennis, rather than suffering from a Windows environment, trying to figure out why 15 programs don't work out of 25.
Right.
So I'll hire a pro, and I'll take the luxury of doing that. So back to calibrating TVs.
Mm-hmm.
Get the information from the press, or buy an inexpensive disc for $25 or $30, or invest in a professional and get it done to the best possible capability of that device. And that is a luxury, and it's what we as a company provide to people all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And luxury is the top-notch entertainment you can get from your machine. So if someone's walking in with sometimes $10,000 and $15,000 worth of test equipment, optimizing your TV to your room and your electronics, and they may be there half a day or three quarters of a day, and it'll be done as best as it can be done. But
yes,
we do understand it's a luxury, and right now we're reaching about 2% of the people in America. So compared to where we were 10 years ago, we are now actually measurable as opposed to being noise for. It was just the magazine readers and, you know, a few hundred calibrators as opposed to, you know, lots of people in the mainstream and over 5,000 calibrators worldwide. So we've had an interesting run.
Mm-hmm.
Press is part of it. You folks have helped. But you went home and did your own TVs. You did the TVs you reviewed, and you said, well, this needs to be written up. So we thank you for the help you've given us over the years. And the calibrators, they appreciate the fact that we're in the public domain more than we ever were. We're never going to be mainstream, but calibration services are now becoming something that more and more people understand they need, even though they may not partake of the luxury to have it done.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And one of the reasons I'll bet that ISF and calibration in general has achieved more of a mainstream appeal, even if it's only 2%, that's still, as you say, measurable, is that ISF, Imaging Science Foundation, is now training the technicians that Best Buy sends out. When you buy a TV from Best Buy and you contract with them, pay some extra amount of money, whatever it is, to have their technicians come out and calibrate your TV, you're actually training them. And I think that's a wonderful thing.
Well, they've been a superb client. And I will tell you, they were a cautious, conservative, and extremely patient client. First ventures with them were they're sending, you know, dozens of people in for trainings, then spending time with groups of 50 at strategic planning in Minneapolis at the headquarters, and then them determining at what point would flat panel sales be large enough to justify equipping hundreds of their people with multiple thousands of dollars worth of test equipment, multiple thousands of dollars worth of training, a vehicle, and then all the people that schedule their services all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And scheduling is a really fine art for them to have a route for 580 people established weeks in advance. It's time consuming. And that requires efficiency that they're really good at. Our normal ISF dealer is a custom installer. Average employee is somewhere between, you know, 5 to 7 to 10. A handful of our guys are over 20. But they're dealing with luxury homes. They calibrate the audio. They calibrate the video. They program the remote controls. They automate the lighting. They build smart homes. So calibration becomes one of a menu of services in a luxury Cedia type dealer environment. Now, I don't know if your readers are familiar with Cedia. It's the Custom Electronic Design Industry Association. These are the custom installers working in carriage trade homes down here in Florida on the oceanfront. California, you're also on the oceanfront. These are luxury homes where everything is done perfectly. And that's where we started. The cost is no object. And zooming forward 15 years when we started, I'm just amazed at how many people who teach school have normal everyday jobs. They're well-educated but not affluent. And they've been calling us for 10 to 15 years trying to find a calibrator. And since most of our calibrators are small companies, they can't handle 15 or 20 calibrations a month. They're busy doing 15 or 20 installations a year. So Best Buy saw that opportunity, stepped in, and it's been taking care of literally thousands of people per week on a regular basis who never bought from Best Buy. They bought elsewhere. They just wanted a calibration. And as far as Best Buy's customers, what they found was an extraordinary high level of customer angst and dissatisfaction 5 years ago in flat panel TVs. Where people were unhappy with what they saw when they plugged it in, return rates were high, and the fussy people knew something was wrong. Those fussy customers, the fastidious ones, became calibration customers, became happy customers. So return rates with calibration are effectively zero. If something's put in the right aspect ratio, so 1080p works, HDMI problems are resolved, calibration for the room is taken care of, calibration for the daytime viewing and the nighttime viewing is taken care of. Customers are happy, but we've known that in luxury homes for 15 years. The fact that more and more of the mainstream dealers are jumping on is refreshing. We've also just finished a training for Best Buy in Birmingham, UK, and we had two trainings last month in Istanbul, in Turkey.
No kidding. Wow.
We're also operational in the Mexico City store, and we just finished two trainings in China with over 50 people per at public trainings. And I think I mentioned there's a private company in Hong Kong called Fortress with 50 stores doing calibration for customers there who tend to be quite technical, quite well-read, and extremely difficult because they know what they're buying. So the brightest customers become our best customers, and they return TVs from places where they don't get what they paid for. What's intimidating to many people is when you look at a menu of a TV set and you start scrolling through these adjustments, the names of the adjustments make no sense to the end user. The volume of adjustments is downright intimidating. Where a calibrator looks at those adjustments, it goes, wow, I've got everything I need. So the key thought is, if you've got 5 or 6 pages of adjustments that you paid for, why did the manufacturer put them in there? And why did they engineer them in? So we feel to get value from your TV sets, you should use the tools the manufacturer put into the TV to make it look good in your room, in your lighting, with your inputs, be they be standard definition, high definition satellite, cable, telephone, Blu-ray. And as bad as they are, you know, most TVs nowadays have, you know, some pretty decent scalers. Again, we mentioned before, they're perfect scalers, but the scale you get in some of the better TVs nowadays is embarrassingly good. They're very good compared to what we said, you know, spent $10,000 to $15,000 on 12 years ago. We've got better scalers now for free than we used to spend the price of a car on.
So, right, on an external box that did that scaling.
Yeah, that took 2 hours to set up. Now it comes for free on a $110 chipset. Of course, big improvement over the $18 chipset, but the expensive TVs have decent scalers. And you have a much better scaler on the outside. So the external scalers on the market right now are really good because they've had to get really better than the decent ones inside the TV sets.
Yeah. You mentioned calibrating your TV for day and calibrating your TV for nighttime viewing. And I wanted to just mention that, a number of TVs are available now with what are called the ISF CCC modes. And there's a ISF day mode and an ISF night mode. And why don't you tell us a little bit about these? Because I think these are kind of important.
Well, let me explain the history behind it. One of the best TVs made in the early days was the Pioneer series. And among the Pioneers, the elites were the best. And a lot of our dealers handled them. And we were going into what was a service mode to calibrate the Pioneers. It required a couple of funny button presses, and you had to know certain codes, and it was difficult to do. Mm-hmm. And one of the Pioneer product managers accused us of hacking the televisions. That you're hackers. You're going into our service mode. You don't belong there. And he ended up coming to a training to find out who these hackers were. And we'll mention his name. His name is Josh Karoff, kind of a famous guy now.
Oh, yeah. He's been a guest on the podcast, actually.
Okay. He invented the Kuro. He's one of the most brilliant people in TV. He's a fabulous engineer. And he said, well, what's it going to take to get you guys to stop hacking the service mode? And I said, well... If the adjustments we need weren't in the service mode, we wouldn't hack your TVs to get there. But I asked him if he hacked his own TV at home. And he said, of course I calibrated my TV. He grew up in the broadcast business where you match 12 Pioneer panels behind a newscaster. And there's nothing more critical than multi-panel displays for a video wall to make calibrators sharp, and Josh is one of the top calibrators on the planet. So we had a good laugh, and we asked him two things. We said, one, can you give us a mode that's for dealers? Two, after we spend 3 hours calibrating the set, can you let us lock it? And I think I embarrassed him by saying, look, even Microsoft Word lets you press save. We have to be able to save the adjustments, and since with flat panels, they're very bright, they can make pictures in bright rooms. Memory's cheap. Let's have two locking modes. And Pioneer changed our business. They were the first manufacturer to recognize that their dealers were an integral part of customer satisfaction. Mm. They gave us two locking modes per input. And I'll give Josh all the credit for starting this. And Josh now works with us on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. We've sent him to many manufacturers. He solves problems all over the world. And his expertise is building menus for calibration and building TVs that we've seen have some of the best pictures we've ever seen in a television business. The Pioneer Kuro that he engineered stands as a landmark.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, still does, even to this day. People ask me, what should I buy? You know, I said, well, if you can find a Kuro, buy that.
Well, the key thing is if you can find it. The intriguing thing that your readers and viewers may not know is that the Kuro team is back in the TV business with a new company.
So Panasonic. Josh is
with Panasonic. So we expect to see in June some interesting launches from the Kuro team working now in a $9 billion Panasonic plant.
Yes.
So Josh's work continues, and there's still communication between him and his friends because they basically put a line in the sand about picture quality and people respect them around the world. But he changed us. Now, what we did with his TV sets, he goes, will you endorse the TVs if we do this? And I said, well, I can't get them calibrated from the plant. You're going to make them engineered for calibration. So what we can certify is that the calibration controls are, one, there, two, effective, and three, locking. So if you see a CCC and an ISF on a TV set, it doesn't mean it's knowledgeable about your home and knows whether you hooked up a Wii or a Blu-ray player. What it does have is controls per input for a calibrator to come in there, safely calibrate the TV without delving into a service mode, be able to do it for day and night performance, and most importantly, lock those controls. So if the dog steps on the remote control and hits the reset button, 4 hours of calibration do not disappear.
Yes.
So this was initially a Pioneer venture, followed by Runco, followed by Panasonic, followed by Epson, followed by Onkyo and receivers, and the list goes on. But we've met the equivalent of Josh's brilliance in many companies.
Mm.
And sometimes calibrators will sit there saying, what were these companies thinking? And I'll tell them they weren't thinking about listening to the engineers they have on staff. So we found some, Josh was our first discovery inside Pioneer. We've met some equally brilliant people in many of the manufacturers. And one of the things that we've helped happen is that their marketing people are listening to the engineers and permitting the engineers to do their job, to build the best TV they can for the budget.
This is really great news.
Well, we've made a lot of friends with a lot of people and a lot of companies that we didn't know exist. And when all of a sudden I get a phone call from Germany and another phone call from Belgium and products come here, these are people just trying to get the best products they can with the budgets they have. And that means building in calibration menus. So it's been a fun ride with a lot of good people.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of work behind the scenes if you see that logo on the TV set.
Yeah.
We've got some, if you look at just an LG chassis, not an expensive TV, you've got some very complex things called, 10-point RGB gamma controls. What does that mean in plain English? That means we can make it behave like a much more expensive TV set if a calibrator takes the time.
Yes.
You've got a lot of controls now that make no sense to the end users, but the calibrators look at it and go, oh, that's good.
Yes. Calibrators and reviewers.
Yes. I got to lump you with calibrators. You look at that and you'll go, wow, I can make this thing really work. And
yes.
With your skill set, an hour or two later, you've transformed the TV set.
Yes.
That's the intention. So when that happens in more and more people's homes, the other thing we find is that the calibrators tend to like their work. We have a happy group. They go to people's homes, they leave things better than they found it. They have fun with TVs and they get paid. So it's not a bad way for young people to make a living in the big boxes.
And that brings up the next point I wanted to talk about, which was that any user can, with your $30 HD TV calibration wizard disc, set up the basic controls and get a better picture than they would have straight out of the box. But to get that extra mile, you need to either hire a calibrator, or if you're interested in becoming a calibrator, ISF offers training as well. Anyone who wants to can sign up and go attend your training, right?
Well, I'm one of the people who was fortunate enough to be able to give up my day job and calibrate for a living. And it took a number of years in those days before I could do that. Strange enough, we've never had a training from the very first one in 1994 without an end user coming in, either out of curiosity or because he wants his own set calibrated, or he's had it with his day job and he wants to learn how to get into the business.
Yes.
So we've had a number of people come through training. We just finished in San Francisco last week. I'll be in Vancouver in 3 weeks. Then we'll be off to Germany and back over to Shanghai. So there's trainings happening all over the world. And we've met some nice people who tend to be the people you want in your home. They're fussy. They're fastidious. They like equipment. They like pressing buttons. And they're patient. So we find the calibrators start out just calibrating, and we lose more calibrators when they become dealers. What we see on a regular basis, a calibrator decides to be a calibrator. Then he finds the TV's hooked up S-video out of a high-definition satellite receiver.
Ugh.
Now he has to go buy a cable. Then all of a sudden he finds the center channel speaker is embarrassing, and no one set audio levels anywhere. So now he has to set audio levels and maybe replace a speaker. Then he finds the receiver won't handle HDMI, so he buys the customer a new receiver. And before you know it, our calibrator is a dealer. And he's only doing 10 and 12 calibrations a year.
Right.
We've seen this hundreds and hundreds of times, and they're still in the business. They're not doing what their plan was, but they're having a good time taking care of fewer customers, but taking care of everything for that customer.
Yeah, yeah.
And
I have to admit. Sorry, go ahead.
That's the flow we're seeing. People come into the business and just grow and thrive. And like most anything else, if you're doing what you like for a living, you're going to be good at it. So
that's
our guys
right.
have a good time. They like their work and they thrive.
So recommendations or advice do you have for anyone listening who might be interested in pursuing this as a career? I know I get several emails a month or even a week that say, I'm interested in getting into this as a profession. What do I need to do?
Well, first suggestion, follow the experts. Find the writers like yourself who calibrate. Read the reviews. See what they're finding.
Mm-hmm.
Two, buy all the discs. There are a number of test discs in the market. Buy them all. Learn them. One particular one is interesting. You've probably seen Stacy Spears disc, the Spears-Munsell disc.
Yep, I've had them on as guests on the podcast as well.
Excellent. I don't know if they mentioned, but on their disc, if you're looking at a pattern and you press the up button, there's a tutorial on the disc.
It's a beautiful thing. It's very well designed. I agree.
That's a mini calibration course by itself. There's also a new software company we're working with called SpectraCal, and they have a program called CalMan. There's a hobbyist version for a few hundred dollars. We have the professional ISF version, which is $2,500. That's a good amateur learning tool, but there's a small calibration course in there as well. So like in any other new profession, we recommend people do their due diligence, read, learn, experiment as best they can. If they still find it fascinating, which most do, come for training. Get your feet wet. Yeah. Meet the other people in the room, meet the dealers. And the best advice I can give people is to meet the people in the business. See if they're like-minded. See if they're having fun. See if they're in the spots you want to be in a few years. And most of our dealers and calibrators, even through the recession, had good business, had loyal customers, did more and more service. I will tell you, the Blu-ray disc players are creating a need for service that we've never seen before. I don't know if anyone has spoken through your magazines about AACS and digital rights management, but we need to protect...
Not very much.
Let me go on my soapbox on this for a little bit. Number one,
please.
There are more movies stolen than sold. So that's got to stop. We've got to be able to support the creative artists who entertain me when I watch movies. So we have to be able to protect content. The AACS, a digital rights management initiative that is on every Blu-ray movie, does offer upgradable, changeable copy guard. And that means the Blu-ray player should be connected to the web for updates, which is hard because not all the Blu-ray players have a jack to be connected to the web.
So sadly not, but more and more are.
Some are, and more of them are never connected to the web because that's beyond the capability of most of the end users. You've got to get a jack and a wire. So what we have all our calibrators doing, including the Best Buy calibrators, is carrying discs to upgrade players when you visit a client's home so the movies will play. Now, we've never had this before, but I've had the good fortune of traveling the world, and I've been in subways and bus stations and airports where I've seen current movies stolen for sale at ridiculous prices. And some of them come from high-def masters with high-def camcorders, and they're shockingly good-looking stolen movies. This is not good for our business. So I'm a big fan of digital rights management. I love the fact that if a movie gets hacked, we can change the copy guard for the next movie. We will never eliminate the hacking, but if we cut it down, the studios will thrive. If they thrive, I'll get more entertainment.
And so will everybody else.
Well, why'd you start this business? Well, I'll tell you, when I was with the magazines, I managed to get my hands on a product we're reviewing from one of my personal heroes. And I'm sure you probably remember Henry Kloss and the Kloss Nova Beam televisions. I had one of those when I was working with the magazines like yourself in my home. And I was mesmerized by it. And we just couldn't get it to really work. It wasn't quite ready for prime time. And the more we focused it, the more we saw the scan lines. And the more we saw the scan lines, the more we saw what was wrong with 1939 television. And it was an exercise in fascination and frustration. And as we evolved into things like Ferrugia line doublers and magnetically focused CRTs, picture quality just exploded. And I found, when I brought my friends over to look at the old Kloss Nova Beam, they looked at this big screen. Their eyes went, wow. When I turned it on, they didn't like the picture, and they kind of laughed at us for, you know, what'd you spend on this, and how much is this? And it looks funny. And over the years, the same friends have been coming to my house, you know, same routine, sit down in front of a big screen, ask questions, drink a glass of wine. But all of a sudden, no one's laughing at our pictures anymore. They just, you know, fight for the best seat in the theater and come over more often because our pictures are impeccable. Why did I get into this? Well, I wanted my own picture to look good. And I watch a lot of movies, so I'm a big fan of content protection because I want to be able to do simple things like sign up for Netflix and get movies sent to my house on a regular basis and buy $100 million worth of movie for $29, which is phenomenal.
Right, so it is.
Good getter for content, but this all comes down to someone having a Blu-ray disc that doesn't play. Because the player has to be updated. And I do think there's a service that our dealers should be performing, and all dealers should be performing. Houses should be visited periodically with projectors. Lamps have to be replaced. Blu-ray players have to be updated. Cables now may have to be replaced. With new systems and 3D coming, audio video receivers may have to be replaced. So with innovation comes the need for periodic customer service, which we think is part of the responsibility that Calibrator has.
Mm-hmm.
So we think that a good local business going, you know, 20 to 100 miles is the basis for most of our calibrators and most of our high-end dealers to build good local relationships with a select number of clients and just service their needs. And that's worked out to be a nice story for thousands of people around the world.
Yeah, yeah. Now, people should know if they are thinking of going into this business, there is an investment. In the training. I mean, your training isn't free. It costs something for people.
Training is relatively inexpensive compared to the cost of the equipment.
Right. And the equipment is the main expense. I mean, you can spend as little as, $1,000 or so for a, you need some sort of device that senses the color coming off the TV and some software to run on a computer, and you hook the sensor up to the computer, all the way up to tens of thousands of dollars for the highest end, even hundreds of thousands probably for the real high end stuff. But, you know, we're not talking chicken feed here.
No, meters start at about $89 and, like you say, go up to the price of exotic sports cars.
Yes.
And what a calibrator needs is something that, A, is portable. So the most expensive gear is out because the TVs go to the most expensive gear. The most expensive gear is bench-driven material for designing and experimenting on TVs. So you need something portable. You need something rugged. And most of the expensive lab gear is not rugged enough to take on airplanes on a regular basis. It is indeed lab equipment. So there's always a compromise between speed of measurement, and you've used some of the spectroradiometers that take too long to read. So in a magazine environment, you must have that gear.
Yes.
In a field environment, it's too slow.
Yes.
And you have to send your gear out twice a year for very expensive calibration.
Yes.
But you're running a lab. So a lab tool versus a field tool is an important distinction. Our people need good, solid field tools that come as close as possible to a lab tool, which brings the cost generally closer to $4,000 to $7,000, which is still a fraction of what you invest in lab gear, but it's effective from the field.
Yes.
Also finding the LED TVs have increased the need for spectral devices. So the entry-level piece gear that used to work well on phosphor-based devices no longer works well on LED-based flat panels.
Mm-hmm. So, because the color gamut is so different.
Well, the light source, the wavelengths is different. That brings up another pet peeve. Forgive my soapbox, but I'll call them LED-based LCDs. I'll be very careful not to call them LED TVs because they're
is,
not.
Yes,
and,
they're not.
I was actually with a dealer in Hong Kong who won't run any of the ads that say LED TVs because it's, in his mind, something that might be punishable by law. Because something, but it's not, and under Chinese law, that's punishable. So they are not calling anything LED TVs. They're calling it LCDs with LED backlights, but that's just me feeling bad for my friends who asked me about the LED TVs they just bought, and I've got to be the bad guy and telling them, sorry, that's an LCD.
Right.
And they'll argue with me, no, I bought an LED. So it makes for an interesting conversation. By the second glass of wine, they're no longer as mad as they were. But,
And if I know you're a wine cellar, they're really not very mad anymore.
No, they're happy campers at the end, but it's the nature of our business. We don't always give people proper descriptions on products or product
features. It's true. It's true. And I have to say that I, at first, was very opposed to the term LED TV, as meaning LCD TV with LED backlighting. That's not something that exactly rolls off the tongue. And I've come to accept that LED illumination is significantly different from cold cathode fluorescent, or CCFL, which is the conventional type of illumination in LCD TVs. So I perhaps am a little more tolerant of the term LED TV than you are, but I do recognize the problem. Absolutely.
Oh. It's a problem. It's also an opportunity. Because it's an LED light source, it behaves more like a projector than a traditional fluorescent tube. So you're going to see new generations of LCD light valves that are optimized for the LED backlights. So yes, it's a wonderful light source. It's extremely bright. It's got tremendous energy efficiency. So environmentally, it's a nice machine.
And very green.
For one, For one other topic that is a video file topic, it produces lots of colors, many more colors than we need for HDTV, but we're going to segue into talking about more colors sooner or later in this conversation. So this
and here it is. Time. You've done it perfectly, beautifully.
Okay, so the colors we're looking at in HDTV are better, meaning there's more colors in HDTV than there were in SD, standard definition television, by a small amount. I mean, it's significant. Pictures are better, but it's an evolutionary change, and it needed to be. It needed to be evolutionary because in just America alone, there were over 250 million NTSC monitors. So if the HD content was dramatically different color, it wouldn't look right on the old TVs. We're also dealing with literally hundreds of millions of hours of old NTSC content, which will for decades be played back on HDTV monitors. So the old stuff can look pretty good on the new stuff can look pretty good on the old. So it was brilliant to have an evolutionary change. What is revolutionary? Well, back in the old 1953 era, we tried to make a much better color television system than we ended up with. The aim of the NTSC engineers was to produce many more colors than we were forced to settle for by about 1979. So we failed to build in an engineering fashion for people to buy what the architects of our television system wished, which is for a very large color gamut or color space or many more colors. We settled on SMPTE-C colors, which were a subset of the big colors we wanted to. Let's hold that thought for a while. And we went from a small amount of colors, increased it a little bit in HDTV. But the original dream of 1953 actually came close to fulfillment with Adobe color space. So the LED backlit LCDs and the new generation of LED projection devices finally have the capability of producing way, way more colors than NTSC with SMPTE phosphors or NTSC intended way back when. So we went from a big dream having lots of colors. We settled for a much smaller color space. We expanded the amount of colors in HDTV, and voila, nowadays for about $500 in a camera, you can get Adobe color, which is many, many more colors than HDTV.
Right. So, now, why was it, before we go there, I just want to get a little historical perspective. Why was it that we couldn't implement a TV system with that broad range of colors that they wanted in 1953?
Well, I'll give you a complicated story. We actually could have implemented those colors if we went with the original plan for American Color TV, which was a black and white TV set with color filters and a wheel in front of it. So color filters could have given us a much bigger number of colors. That system was never implemented. It wasn't very practical. It did, however, surface in DLP generations later, but our color television system became a reality with phosphors that glowed in colors when you hit them with electrons. So the electron beam inside color TV sets lit up red, green, and blue phosphors, hence color television. The colors for red, green, and blue were limited in phosphors. The green that would have given the exact color we wanted back in the 50s actually existed. It was used in oscilloscopes. But like in scopes, if you lit it up, it stayed lit, had persistence. So the idea on paper was good. We failed to implement it because the engineering for the phosphors was inadequate.
Now, the formulation of phosphors, we didn't have the phosphors available to us. For example, the green that exhibited little or no persistence.
Yeah, it just not a workable solution. The red was too inefficient. So if you think of the 1953 post-war mentality, we were thinking that we don't have these phosphors now, but 1953, we'll sketch it on paper. We're going to go on the air in 1964. We've got a decade. We can do anything. Well, we learned to eat a little humble pie because we couldn't quite do anything. The laws of physics do catch up with you, even if you have big egos as engineers. So we settled on a smaller amount of crayons. I tend to call color space a box of crayons. In fact, when you were young, you may remember some of the kids had that big box of crayons with the sharpener in the back. Do you remember that?
Sure, I do. Absolutely.
How many crayons were in that box?
64. 128, maybe.
Do you have those?
I don't anymore. I did at one time, yeah.
Rich kids had those back then. You know, they had more colors. Do you remember the sharpener in the back?
Oh, yeah, I do.
What did that give you?
Finer lines.
Resolution. More,
what's that?
Resolution.
Resolution, yes, exactly right.
More colors and resolution, the same thing we're looking for today. So jumping into Adobe Colors, we've got much, much better color space or more colors. Yeah. And one of the problems we have right now, and it's a classic situation that you've jumped on aggressively, and I thank you for it, color television is a rather simple system. You capture a picture carefully with the camera. You preserve it with some type of system, be it NTSC, PAL, CCAM, Blu-ray, and you try and reproduce it exactly the way it was produced.
Yes.
And it's very much like a turntable. You cut an album at 33 and a third RPM, and there's no license to play it back at 39. It may sound zippier, but it's wrong.
Right.
We now have a whole movement with some of these TVs that can produce more colors, actually trying to produce too much color and distorting the color by changing reproduction into a mirror image of production into something other than a mirror image, which means it's just wrong. So
yes, I've railed against this virtually my whole career is TV companies that tout a wider color gamut, greater range of colors, more is obviously better, right? And I say, well, no, you want to reproduce what was produced in the first place, and that used us when they produced the film or the movie or the TV show or whatever, it's produced within a certain range of colors, and your TV should be able to reproduce that certain range of colors, the same range of colors.
Well, we've never had an environment before, marketing people all bragging about the ability to be wronger than the next. But, you know, it makes for good advertising, and it also creates an opportunity for education that you're fulfilling for the clients. But the intriguing thing about having bigger colors means another system, like for me, reproducing pictures of my children in Adobe Color. And I mentioned before, most cameras over $500 might have a button you can press to capture in Adobe Color space. Mm-hmm. Or Adobe RGB, it means you're going to create raw files. It'll burn a little bit more memory. And what I like to do as a photographer want to be, I capture JPEGs and Adobe at the same time. That way I have things
some
like
colors
email,
will do that, though.
A lot of cameras,
some cameras will do that. They'll capture both at the same time.
It's actually reason to buy a camera. You can capture the new, archive it, and capture the old and email it. And if you happen to get lucky, and you know, in photographic terms, you've heard me say this every now and then under the photographic principle that even a blind squirrel sometimes gets a nut. we all get a magnificent shot, and you want to email it, you want to use it for your desktop, you want to put it on your phone, and you want to print it. And if you send it out for professional print and you have Adobe files, you will get a magnificent looking picture, better than you email. And it's just a little tip for all of our readers and viewers to understand that we will have Adobe Color Space monitors with LEDs in the future.
Yes.
HDMI is to be given many kudos. I know many people pick on HDMI.org. I won't pick on them. I think they're leading the charge for advancement. The HDMI 1.4 already incorporates Adobe Color Space. And we've got numerous cameras at many budgets that have HDMI connections on them. So they're laying the groundwork for more color.
Yep.
And as we speak, Digital Cinema Initiatives, the DCI group, are producing in colors way beyond HDTV colors for professional cinema. And our dream is one day we'll get those in my theater, your theater, and we'll be writing about a new millennium worth of color instead
yes.
of being proud of ourselves for finally being able to reproduce something close to the 1953 that someone had way back when.
But, what was old is new again, huh?
Well, but the people that we designed the television system to speak to haven't changed. Human factors are the same. We've just finally gotten the engineering capability to acquire those images, store the images, and reproduce the images. So I see a very bright, no pun intended, a very bright, colorful future. maybe I'll be radical and say that I look at a monitor as something that does TV entertainment. It surfs the web. It plays my pictures. It enables me to do racing games, which I like. And it's just a monitor. It shouldn't be a TV set. It should take care of everything I want to have on a screen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I raised my kids. They were playing games on big screens, surfing the web on big screens. And it was good family entertainment. And that's mm-hmm. taken us a long way. So seeing these colors is wonderful, but I think you've hit it on the head. The fact that you can make more colors doesn't give you a franchise to make the picture wrong.
Exactly. Exactly.
But it does make for a tempting demo when you put it in a lineup with 50 other TV sets. If one of them is wronger, it might just sell. So we had this with bluer, brighter, sharper, and now wronger on colors. ultimately, you know, manufacturers have to do what they have to do to survive at retail.
Yeah.
And the astute customers, like in any other sport, the astute customers will get the right information, get the tools they can afford, partake of luxuries if they can, and optimize their products. I do with a number of sports and hobbies I have, and video is just one of them. But in most places, I have found, you know, good people to guide me and good people to take care of my passions and get my machines running properly mm-hmm. and give me high performance.
Yes.
So it always requires, you know, a little due diligence, finding the right people, and a little patience. And home theater and audio video is no different than any other sport. The right people will help you get the performance you're looking for.
Now, it's interesting you mentioned other activities. A reader recently sent me an email, or maybe it was posted a comment on my recent calibration blog, and said, why is this? I mean, you don't buy a car and have to immediately take it to a mechanic to get a tune-up. You know, it's supposed to work right away. Now, we've talked about why that isn't the case in video and TVs in particular, but it struck me as a very astute thing to say. Of, you know, there are other products that you buy that you shouldn't have to, that you don't have to immediately change, tune up, make better. They're not bad out of the box, but in the case of TVs, they often are because of this difference between the showroom environment and the home environment, and the fact that they have to look good in the showroom environment.
Well, I'll add one other parameter to that. It's not just the showroom environment and the home environment. It's the fact that people don't understand what they're buying with televisions versus automobiles and other products. They understand what quality is in automobiles, and you find the reviews of automobiles to be, you know, quite accurate, and parameters that make one better than another are well understood. Where parameters that make TV better are not well understood. So we've come a long way in the past 4 or 5 years, just increasing awareness that something should be done. And actually, if you take most of the TV sets that are on the market, there is a better option from the factory than the factory preset.
So well, that reminds me. I was going to ask you one more question about that. And that's, what do you think of THX mode? Some TVs are THX certified, and they have a mode that you can choose in the menu called THX, which is supposed to get you into this accurate area that we've been talking about. Have you found that to be true, more or less?
Well, your reviews have said the same thing. It is another good mode. If you look at most TV sets, there's either a movie mode or a theater mode or an expert mode that's our best guess, and I'm part of this process with a number of my clients. We're taking the best guess we can at a home environment, and we're building it in. THX has done a good job of taking it a step further. They're asking them to make the grayscale and the color space a better guess. But, for example, if you're looking at the projectors that are aiming at accuracy, accuracy in a projector is tricky, accurate on what screen, mm-hmm. with what source. But I'll applaud any manufacturer for trying to deliver a set with a mode that's superior, and getting the recognition that the mode's there is the hardest possible part. We had this with our work with Sony years ago. We actually labeled one of the earlier modes in the Sony TVs NTSC, the standard for television. And, of course, we failed because no one knew what NTSC meant, and no one knew to press the button. But it was our best guess at how to make that TV look good at home. So the simplest thing for an end user to do is to find the mode that's the best guess by a manufacturer at home lighting versus store lighting. And that's a step in the right direction. We never had that in the old days. You had to actually redo every adjustment by hand, which was just too hard to do. So yes, having those modes is really useful. And for a calibrator, we'll start in those modes because it's a third or halfway there. And they're designed and engineered to be calibrated in those modes. But can they do it perfectly at the plant for your home? No.
No, because they don't know what your home is like.
Nor do they know your gear. The other thing we should probably mention talking about gear, thankfully, a lot of Blu-ray players now come with their own internal adjustments. And I'll just ask all your readers to look at the menus of a Blu-ray player before you take it home. If they don't have their own simple controls for brightness and contrast, color and tint, maybe gamma or sharpness, don't buy it. Because we can't build precision Blu-ray players at consumer prices. So some of the best designed Blu-ray players are expensive. They have extensive menus. They can be calibrated in minutes to be accurate. But even at $6,000, we just worked on two Blu-ray players at $6,000. Great products, both of which needed small adjustments to be accurate. Both could be adjusted literally in under 5 minutes to be on the money to match a reference generator. So why are they good Blu-ray players? Not because they're $6,000, because they have adjustments to match a generator. So we calibrate systems. So the Blu-ray player should have an adjustment. Mm-hmm. One of the dreams we have is one day to find satellite and cable gear with adjustments.
Yes.
One of the dreams that's being fulfilled right now is a number of video cards that have adjustments for TV.
Computer video cards.
Yes. We're seeing tremendous advantages in computer video cards. Some of them actually will do TV settings instead of PC settings. Mm. And that gets beyond the technology we can deal with here. But you've written stories about the digital specifications for 16 to 235 versus 0 to 255.
Yep.
And it's TV versus PC. And the fact that PCs can pretend they're good TV sources at the press of a button is impressive.
Yes.
Some of the work we started doing back in 2002 with Microsoft is now finally leaking its way into the market in very good computer products. Mm. And starting to see a lot of TV programs being watched for free on PCs.
Yes.
Just in a university dorm doing some work at the university, and we found very few kids actually looking for TV sources to watch TVs. The cable TV in the wall was not subscribed to. They were just watching everything for free on their PCs.
You know, I know a lot of kids who do that as well.
Well, they don't have $100 a month for a cable bill.
Right.
But they're pretty PC savvy, and everything on cable they find on the PC.
Mm-hmm.
Which is free and down in quality.
Yes, there's the rub, as I've been saying lately. It's less quality.
You get what you pay for. But they're a university. They have no money. If they're finding the content when they graduate, get jobs, they'll find the content and have the money to pay for the quality. Let them enjoy the content at whatever quality they can afford. So I'm happy with that solution. But getting the PC into the living room helps people watch pictures on their TV. So I get kind of frustrated when someone invites me over to see a picture of their trip that they just went on, and I'm asked to go look at the pictures on a 13-inch laptop monitor with 12 people in the room. I mean, that's not what a laptop is. Now, if the laptop has an HDMI out, you go plug it into the TV, and now everyone enjoys the photos.
Yes.
Kind of like what our dads did years ago with slide projectors, but a whole other level of quality and convenience.
Whole other level. Yes, I agree. Well, I actually want to get you back on the show sometime to talk more specifically about PCs in the home theater, because I know there are a lot of people who are interested in that. But we're going to have to save that for next time. I do want to ask your opinion on one other subject before we go, and that is the explosion of 3D TV.
Well, it's long overdue. We were watching some crude TV with twin colored gels for generations, and all of a sudden we've got the technology to actually send two pictures in the space of time that one picture came along. Now, 3D is definitely the buzzword this year.
Yes.
We've had a lot of people ask, are you really going to buy one because there's no content? Well, I'm one of the people who bought an HD TV when the only HD content I had was a demo loop from DirecTV that got kind of old, but it was beautiful. We only had an hour, but we all bought HD TVs. So we're going to have a few movies here and there. If we look back at the history of 3D, I think it's going to find an interesting turning point. We had the whole ball of wax resting on one man's shoulders with one movie. It was all about Avatar.
Yes.
And they knocked it out of the park.
They really did, didn't they?
They really did. It was fine entertainment. It was a beautiful movie, and I can't wait to get it in 3D on Blu-ray, which we'll have in the not-too-distant future. But it was a launch of a technology that was fun. Was it flawed? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Did I find the movie theater glasses too dark? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that will fix itself because we'll learn how to double the lamp output in the theater when we play 3D. And I've got calibrators overseas doing that. These are commercial calibrators. And the Digital Cinema Initiative spec is 14-foot Lamberts. So if you're looking at polarized glasses, we lose 50% of the light. It's easy. You flip it to 28-foot Lamberts for 3D. So as much as the glasses cost you half, you got a lamp bulb with the higher setting. You set it for double. It now looks good. I didn't have that experience with Avatar. It was too dark.
Yeah. It was dark. I agree. The one I saw was as well. Although you could either have a lamp with twice the brightness or stack projectors.
Projectors. I'd love stack projectors, but that's never going to happen. The cost is just too high. It's even expensive to get a larger lamp than we need, but that's at least within the realm of possibility. Two projectors does not make a business plan.
Yeah. Now, I've had the thought recently that doing the similar thing on 3D TVs at home, flat panels in particular, plasmas in particular, could shorten the life of the plasma TV because you're putting it in torch mode essentially.
Well, it depends upon what you build the TV to output. If we're looking for 38 to 40 foot Lamberts in the average plasma for the average nighttime setting, and that's about our recommendation for calibrators in the evening. If the set's capability is 80-foot Lamberts, and I've got high-speed phosphors to take care of lag, which we're going to have, we can easily do that. Now, zoom over to an LCD panel, whether it's backlit or not, with LEDs or cold or hot cathodes, we have a backlight control. One of my frustrations right now with the earliest launches of TVs is when you go into 3D mode, you don't have a separate calibration for that mode.
I'm just working on my review of the Samsung TV, which does have a separate calibration per input for 2D and 3D.
That second gen, and we needed that desperately. That means I can set it for double the lamp light for 3D, which I need.
Yep.
And I've got one other worry. I've got a lot of neighbors who are now lining up buying HD TVs, buying 3D TVs, buying glasses for a family of four, and then they'll bring their glasses over to my house. And if my brand TV is not the same, will the glasses from their TV work on mine? The answer is no.
No.
So where are the standards committees we need to be able to say, okay, 3D IR repeaters, here's the spec. What did we have? Chaos once again.
We're already seeing an
aftermarket launch of glasses that will talk to all the TVs, but these are the early bumps in the road. 3D movies are going to be fun. What we're already dealing with is 3D gaming that's been around for a long time. And
that's right.
For an era, over a year and a half now, we've had video cards that will render 2D games as 3D with some decent graphics. So they're doing it movies, of course, because many of the movies that are now 3D were never conceived as 3D.
Right.
They've been reprocessed, as we do with video games, into 3D. And that's kind of fun, but it's brought people into stores. It's brought us thousands of phone calls. It's had mass confusion. It makes people driven to your sites and your magazines. And it's fun. It's the new toy. Do we have enough content? No. Are the bugs out of it? No. Is it fun? Absolutely.
I think this and the content will grow and the bugs will shrink over time.
And the couple of things we worry about, and this may not be the platform for it, but we should launch onto it. Improper composition and non-matching of the zooms between the two cameras causes something we call retinal disparity, and it ups the fatigue factor. So we've got a lot to learn to produce good 3D content, and the calibration of the content and the synchronization of the zoom is going to be necessary. And we're already seeing in Australia some warnings on 3D that it causes fatigue, which, by the way, it does.
Yes.
And if it's rendered properly, you cause less fatigue.
Mm-hmm.
We've also got another, these are high-level geek terms. We start with retinal disparity. We can go to Percival's zone of distortion, or plain English, viewing angle. Your viewing angle on 3D is quite limited, whether it's in the movies or in the home, and it's more limited in the home. So, yes, viewing angle has to be taken into consideration. Content has to be done properly. And again, like you say, these are early days. When it comes to 3D, this is like TV in 1939. It's fun. Is it perfect? When was the last time we had a new toy launch that was perfect? But it's a blast. And, of course, around the corner, right after we get the glasses looking good, right after we get the standard squared away, we'll have auto stereoscopic, which really is 3D. So I'd consider most of what we're seeing now is 3D. I consider it stereo. Two images. The intriguing thing is, for the first time since 1939, we're actually upping the refresh rate of television. In 1939, we started transmitting TV here and abroad. The PAL countries made 50 pictures per second happen. They did that because the AC current in Europe was 50 pictures per second. We did 60 pictures per second for the same crude reason. The power in the wall was 60 cycles.
Right.
We basically transmitted 50 and 60 cycles for the past 80 years. 3D is the first time we're actually sending more pictures per second for real.
Yes.
We're doubling the refresh rate. Now, what does that mean in plain English? Signal's bigger. What won't work? A lot of cables. What else won't work? A lot of AVRs. We've been testing 3D through AVRs. There's good-looking 3D, goes into the AVR, 3D, comes out 2D.
So,
since we've actually really, for the first time, upped the number of pictures per second, for real, a lot of the cables won't work, a lot of the receivers won't work. It's a new toy, it may require a new signal path. Is it worth it?
Yeah.
Seeing it, it's fun. It's worth it. Will there be some customer anxiety and misinformation? Well, less with the people who read your magazines, but in general, a lot out there. So the need for the editorial press to inform the clients is higher. The need for calibrators to keep their customers well-informed is higher. And I still calibrate for a number of dealers here. I enjoy the work. I go out. I'm in some nice homes on a regular basis. All my clients have called me about 3D.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a question of, you know, should I? It's a question of, do you have it now? Should I buy it?
I've often wondered whether or not the hype around 3D, which is clearly generated by the studios and by the manufacturers, is reflected in consumer demand. And I've recently come to believe that it probably is, that there is, in fact, consumer demand for it. And you're verifying that with your own personal experience.
Well, it's a question of demographic. Do you want it? Yes. Can you afford it? Well, if you can, you want it now and you get it now. Like the rest of us, we wait maybe for the second gen. We save ourselves a few dollars. Prices come down. There's less bugs. But the high demographic groups that I work with, they want it now. And they're taking it home now. And they're having more fun now. And the rest of us will have more fun a little later.
A little later. Well, I will do one shameless self-promotion here. I just today launched a new blog on ultimateavmag.com called Ultimate 3D, in which I'm going to be doing my best to educate our readers on exactly that, the real deal about 3D and what's really going on there. So,
good. If you could focus a bit on distortion and retinal disparity and fatigue and let them know it is real and you can minimize it and the broadcasters will get better. Mm-hmm. Camera angles there from their standpoint will get better. Synchronized zooms will get better. But if you can control the viewing angles in your home better, it's a much more comfortable experience. Mm. And congratulations on the blog. Appreciate
Thank
it.
You.
That's great.
Thank you very much. Joel Silver, thanks so much for being on the show. I really appreciate it.
Take care, Scott. Have a good night.
You bet. Be sure to check out Joel's website at imagingscience.com, where you'll find tons of information, training schedules, all kinds of stuff there. My online homes, of course, are ultimateavmag.com and hometheatermag.com. And you can email me with questions or suggestions for future podcast guests at scott@twit.tv. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Etienne Fortin, the CTO of Sensio, speaking of 3D, one of the foremost infrastructure companies in the 3D space. So I'm really looking forward to talking to him, and I sure hope you'll join us. Until then, geek out!